With Thanksgiving a week from today and coronavirus cases exploding across the country, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Thursday recommended against traveling for the holiday, urging Americans to consider celebrating in their own households instead. We'll have more on that story in a minute. This is Washington Today for Thursday, November 19th. I'm John McArdle. First, some other headlines from around the nation's capital. On Capitol Hill today, congressional leaders continue to be at odds over a new coronavirus economic relief bill as Democrats and Republicans remain unable to agree on how large the next package should be and what should be covered. From the White House Coronavirus Task Force held its first briefing with reporters in months. And from the Republican National Committee headquarters, Trump campaign officials, led by the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, provided an update on their own ongoing legal challenges in several key swing states. But we begin at the Centers for Disease Control, where during the agency's first news briefing in months, officials said today that they were alarmed to see 1 million new cases reported across the United States within the past week. CDC officials spoke of the risks of travel and gathering in stark terms, warning that as families get together over the holidays, they could inadvertently bring the deadly disease with them. Here is CDC COVID-19 incident manager Henry Walk earlier today on the briefing call with reporters.
As a country, we are seeing increases in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths because of COVID-19. And we know that you are as alarmed as we are by the rapid spread of COVID-19 across American communities. COVID-19 is turning out to be quite a formidable foe. We must unite in our efforts against this virus, and now more than ever, not let down our guard. There is simply no more important time than now for each and every American to redouble our efforts to watch our distance, wash our hands, and most importantly, wear a mask. More and more scientific data is showing that masks can provide some protection to the wearer. Right now, these steps combined are our best defense against the virus that causes COVID-19. With Thanksgiving approaching, our hearts and minds turn to seeing families and friends as part of one of our nation's great traditions, and we all need to consider the safest way to celebrate this holiday. Amidst this critical phase of the COVID-19 pandemic, CDC is recommending against travel during the Thanksgiving period. For Americans who decide to travel, CDC recommends doing so as safely as possible by following the same recommendations for everyday living during this pandemic. Wear a mask in public settings and on public transportation. Watch distance by staying 6 feet away from others not from the same household, and wash your hands often with soap and water or hand sanitizer.
The CDC's Henry Walk earlier today on a call with reporters. The CDC had previously warned about the risk of holiday travel and recommended that travelers take steps, including checking local restrictions, wearing a mask, maintaining distance, and getting a flu shot. From the White House today, the White House Coronavirus Task Force holding its first briefing with reporters since July. Leading the briefing today was Vice President Mike Pence. This is the Vice President.
And even as we see help on the way, vaccines being developed at a historic pace, as I mentioned before, as we gather today, we are seeing cases and positivity rising across the country. But we approach this moment with the confidence of experience. We know the American people know what to do. We have forged a partnership that is truly seamless with state and local health authorities. And as we'll describe to you today, we've continued to work 7 days a week all throughout this year and up to this very moment to make sure the American people have access to the health care that we'd want any member of our family to have as we meet this pandemic. Now, cases are rising throughout the country. Positivity in the last 30 days has risen from an average of 5% to 10%. And to that end, we've continued the mobilization that began at President Trump's direction early this year. We increased testing from a standing start in the month of February to now. As of today, we've completed more than 170 million tests. And we continue to approve new tests, including an at-home test that the FDA just recently approved. And we're distributing more than 150 million Binax tests to schools and nursing homes around America as we speak.
Vice President Mike Pence. Also at today's White House briefing, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, he encouraged Americans to take the coronavirus vaccine when it becomes available. Here's Dr. Fauci.
We need to actually double down on the public health measures as we're waiting for that help to come, which will be soon. We'll be getting vaccine doses into people at high priority at the end of December. We're not talking about shutting down the country. We're not talking about locking down. We're talking about intensifying the simple public health measures that we all talk about. Mask wearing, staying distance, avoiding congregate settings, doing things to the extent that we can outdoors versus indoors. If we do that, we'll be able to hold things off until the vaccine comes. Now, I've used that metaphor that the cavalry is on the way. If you're fighting a battle and the cavalry is on the way, you don't stop shooting. You keep going until the cavalry gets here, and then you might even want to continue fighting. And then finally, one other final thing about it. The very impressive efficacy, 94.5 and 95% of a vaccine, should motivate individual to realize that this is something you want to participate in. So we're going to be talking to you about it likely here in the future, about why it's important as these vaccine doses roll out, why we have to do two things: continue the public health measure and get vaccinated when the vaccine becomes available.
Dr. Anthony Fauci. And now out to the office of the president-elect in Wilmington, Delaware, following a conference with the leadership team of the National Governors Association. Joe Biden briefed reporters on what he told state chief executives about how his administration would coordinate with states in the fight against coronavirus. This is Joe Biden.
In the meeting, we discussed the challenges that lie ahead in distributing and administering the vaccine. The governors talked about how getting doses of vaccine distributed is just one step. We have to actually get vaccinations into the arms of 330 million Americans. That takes enormous resources, people, product. We discussed the difficulty of that task. It's going to take time. It's going to take coordination. It's going to take the federal government and state governments working hand in glove, working together. The governors all emphasized we need to be clear with the American people about what to expect. No false expectations. Let them know what we anticipate. They all acknowledge that this is going to take a massive public education campaign. And we also need to reach traditionally underserved communities that are being hardest hit by the pandemic: Black, brown, Latino, Latin American community, Native American communities, small towns, rural communities. They talked about that in some detail. Thirdly, we discussed the need to help states with Title 32 funding for the National Guard. That's a fancy way of saying governors need to be able to get funding when they need to bring their National Guard into play. And National Guards are going to have to play this. It costs a lot of money. And governors need that paid for. Governors discussed the need for funding when waiving certain FEMA fees. The fact is that this is a national emergency. That's what FEMA is supposed to deal with. Our view is that should be done. When it comes to deploying the National Guard or COVID or real relief, that should be paid for. You know, that's something Kamala and I will be very focused on. And fourthly, we discussed the implementation of a national mask mandate. 10 governors, Democrat and Republican, have imposed masking requirements and recognize the need for universal masking, north, south, east, and west. It's not a political statement. It's a patriotic duty.
Joe Biden today. During his back and forth with reporters, the president-elect also let it be known that he's settled on his Treasury Secretary pick for his upcoming cabinet. Here's more from Joe Biden.
You'll soon hear my choice for Treasury. I've made that decision. We've made that decision. And you'll hear that either just before or just after Thanksgiving, number one. And you'll find it is someone who I think is will be accepted by all elements of the Democratic Party, from the progressive to the moderate coalitions.
Over the past 7 days, the United States has averaged over 160,000 new coronavirus cases per day. All told, more than 250,000 Americans have died from the disease since February. Indeed, the U.S. COVID-19 outbreak is worse than it's ever been. So why aren't we acting like it? That's the question that Time magazine health staff writer Jamie Ducharme asks in her new cover story for Time. She joins us now. Jamie Ducharme, a week away from the Thanksgiving holiday, are public health officials any more optimistic that the American public will step up their social distancing and other precautionary efforts?
You know, it doesn't sound that way. If anything, I think experts are really concerned by the extent to which people are sort of behaving like life is normal right now, as opposed to this spring when everybody was pretty well locked down. Surveys show that between 30 and 40% of Americans are still planning on having Thanksgiving gatherings as though this were any other year. And given how fast the virus can spread indoors and at these kind of intimate gatherings, I think that's a huge source of concern for many experts.
How much of that current reaction is attributed by those public health officials, by medical professionals, to quarantine and social distancing exhaustion after 8 months of this in the United States?
I think that's a huge part of it. You know, your brain is not great at dealing with stress in these levels for this length of time. It's natural and it's normal that that would start to wear on you and you'd have this feeling of quarantine fatigue, as many are calling it. But it is at the same time extremely important to find ways to push through that because, you know, the numbers are not getting better. It might feel like we know more than we did in April, and that's true to an extent, but this problem is still very real. And there's still not a ton we can do about it other than maintaining social distancing.
But what about the good news that we've had in the past week or so on the vaccine front? With that vaccine closer than ever, are more people just willing to risk it?
Yes, there has been a rare flurry of really good news about the pandemic, which should not be discounted. The news out of Pfizer and Moderna is extremely encouraging that the vaccines have the level of efficacy that they seem to. But, you know, the average person is not going to get those vaccines until it's looking like around April of next year. So that's still quite a few months away. And as good as that news is, it's not, you know, you can't change your lifestyle based on it, at least not yet. It's going to take quite a while for the population to have the level of vaccine coverage necessary to stop doing things like wearing masks and social distancing and limiting your time indoors with other people.
Those public health officials and the medical professionals you talked to for this cover story in Time this week, do they think Americans can be motivated to accept hard lockdowns again, those hard lockdowns like we saw in the spring? And if so, what do you do to motivate them to do that?
Yeah, I do think most experts I've spoken to are optimistic that it can be done. They admit that it's a challenge and it's going to take quite a bit of concerted effort, but I think it can be done. One of the biggest ways is through our elected officials and our leaders, just having clear, consistent communication about A, the reality of the situation and how bad things are, and B, about actionable things that people can be doing, such as canceling holiday travel, wearing a mask when they go out in public, you know, not eating indoors in restaurants, those sorts of things. And I think it's also really important to let scientists and public health officials be the ones to deliver those messages. You know, A, because they're the experts, and B, because studies show that people tend to trust scientific figures and their own doctors as well. So if people, if the experts are the ones delivering these messages, I think that can go a long way towards helping people listen to them.
Do you think the news media is getting in the way of that?
I hope not. I like to think not. I think the news climate right now is difficult in that people listen to the sources that they already trust, and it can be difficult to cut across those lines. But I think if outlets really commit to covering this accurately and in a nonpartisan way and based on the numbers and the data and the science, I think news outlets can actually play a large part in helping people understand the situation.
Jamie Ducharme is a Time Magazine health staff writer. She has the cover story in this week's Time, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
According to former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, the incoming Biden administration has its work cut out, and getting the virus under control should be the number one priority. Speaking with CNN's Julia Chatterley Thursday morning, the 94-year-old former chairman said he had never seen anything like what's happening right now. Here's Alan Greenspan from CNN.
I've never seen a particular situation all during my professional experience, anything like this, trying to forecast where the virus is going is at this particular stage very little more than a guess. And we have to adjust our forecasting and our policies accordingly. This is a very complex forecasting procedure and system, largely because the issue of virus is a very rare phenomenon, once in 100 years.
How long do you think it takes the U.S. economy to recover based on all the challenges we're facing at this moment?
It depends on how quickly they get an operating solution to the virus problem. I would scarcely say we're flying blind. We know a great deal, and we know certainly that if we could bring the virus under control and keep it that way, it is perfectly credible that those who are forecasting that we'll be back to normal by the spring of next year, if not earlier, are not guessing. I mean, they're making sensible judgments, but it's still, I would not consider it the most likely occurrence. In a situation like this, you always have to say, what could go wrong? The major part of the solution here is going to be to get us back to where we were. And that could take a long time. And I'm not convinced at all that we have enough information to know how to deal with this type of problem.
Former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan, earlier today on CNN. Greenspan chaired the Federal Reserve from 1987 to 2006, the second longest tenure in that role. Back on Capitol Hill today, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke out against Speaker Nancy Pelosi, calling her, quote, a roadblock to any new deal on relief for those impacted by the coronavirus. Here's the Minority Leader.
Have you had a single conversation about COVID relief in any substantive manner in the last couple of days?
With who?
With anybody. Anybody who is empowered to make a deal.
Well, in the House, I serve in the House, it'd be the Speaker of the House, no.
Have you talked to McConnell? Have you talked to the White House?
I've talked to McConnell, yes, and I've talked to the White House,
and
yes.
And could you give us a sense of where things are going?
Well, the things are still at the same place. There's one roadblock. There's one big wall that has stopped this the entire time, and it's Speaker Pelosi. I would think after the politics that she played and the election being over, that she'd now put the American public first. She still seems to be in the same position. But the good news is you have 23 Democrats who put their name to a letter back in September who said, if you did not do your job, Speaker Pelosi, we would sign the discharge petition. So now if they keep their word, if their word is true and the letter is right, we can get at least PPP relief going. Yes.
All of this while cases are spiking across the country and in Congress, there are still a number of your conference members that are not wearing masks around the Capitol. Are you concerned about that? And are you concerned that this virus might spread to your colleagues, keeping you all from getting things like the NDAA, government funding, and a COVID relief bill done before the end of the year?
Well, I can continue to get concerned about the rise in the spike. I will tell you, I just went through 2 days of a conference where every single person wore their mask, except for when they were speaking. I think people have been very clear and understand the seriousness to this. I think that is why when we introduced our bill, H.R. 14, we added $47 billion more to help in any need that we can to make sure the vaccine moves further. It is a miracle that we would have a vaccine this year, just as everybody said it would be impossible.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, earlier today on Capitol Hill. Congress hasn't passed any economic relief since April, with Democrats and Republicans unable to agree on how large a package should be and what should be covered. Democrats have repeatedly blocked narrower, more tightly focused coronavirus relief bills proposed by Republicans. Democrats have instead focused on the $3 trillion HEROES Act that was passed in May and a slimmer $2.2 trillion version passed in September. Elsewhere in Washington today, the Trump campaign provided an update on their election legal challenges from the headquarters of the Republican National Committee. Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney for the president, said that the campaign would likely file a lawsuit in Georgia and could even drop lawsuits in New Mexico and Virginia. Here's the former mayor of New York.
I tried many, many cases, as did all my colleagues here. You put a witness on a witness stand, the witness is testifying to their own knowledge. This witness goes on the witness stand and she will say, I was told to adjust the date on the absentee ballots. I witnessed election workers and employees going over to the voting booths with voters in order to watch them vote and coach them for whom to vote. Completely illegal. She will testify to that. I don't know. Biden's people can cross-examine her, but you can't just throw it away. Gee, there's no evidence. Next time you say that, you'll be lying. Because there is evidence. This, oh, by the way, this is public. You can all get it. It's attached to the complaint in Costantino versus the city of Detroit. Then she was instructed by my supervisor not to ask for a driver's license or any photo ID when a person was trying to vote. Don't ask for identification. Why would you not ask for identification? Because you knew that a lot of people not entitled to vote were going to come in and early vote. Because you knew that illegal immigrants were going to be allowed to vote. You knew, if you lived in Philadelphia, unless you do not, that's an Italian expression for stupid, unless you're stupid, you knew that a lot of people were coming over from Camden to vote. They do every year. Happens all the time in Philly. It's about as frequent as getting beaten up at a Philadelphia Eagle basketball football game. Happens all the time. All the time. And is allowed to happen because it is a Democrat, corrupt city. And has been for years. Many, many years. And they carried it out in places they could get away with it.
Rudy Giuliani today. You can find the entire briefing from earlier today on our website at cspan.org. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. I'm John McArdle. Over 2 weeks after Election Day 2020, the battle for control of the U.S. Senate continues in Georgia, with two key runoffs set to take place in early January. We'll speak with New York Times reporter Shane Goldmacher in a minute about the money pouring into the Peach State and how national Democrats and Republicans are marshaling their resources for that Senate showdown there. But first, here are some of the ads on the airwaves right now in Georgia.
Meet Raphael Warnock. He wants you to know he eats pizza with a fork and a knife. He once stepped on a crack in the sidewalk. But Georgians don't care about that. Georgians care that Raphael Warnock was a proud defender of anti-American, anti-Semitic pastor Jeremiah Wright, who suggested America deserved the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
Not God bless America, God damn America!
We celebrate Reverend Wright.
Warnock said law enforcement officers are gangsters and thugs and a danger to children. He's anti-Israel, anti-Second Amendment, sympathizes with Marxists and socialists, and wants to make your neighborhoods less safe. Don't let him fool you with pizza and puppies. Raphael Warnock is too extreme for Georgia.
An appointed senator who's trying to buy an election in Georgia, and she'll do anything desperate to try and do that.
Kelly Loeffler believes that Georgia can be hoodwinked with TV ads. She believes it can be bought.
Her only claim to fame is reelect me, I'll be the richest, still be the richest person in Congress. And I went out and I bought a jet airplane so I could fly back and forth between Georgia and Washington.
If Loeffler knew about these trades and still issued the little PSA we showed you, she should leave office.
You thought the government was prepared, yet shortly after that tweet that I just noted, you sold over $1 million in stocks in your own personal portfolio before the market went down. Were you trading on inside information about what was coming?
Could you tell me what was fake? What was fake? Was it the timing of the sale, that it had nothing to do with that coronavirus briefing? When did you sell the stock? Was it after that briefing, before that briefing?
We cannot afford to let this election slide. We can't afford to somebody who doesn't know what she believes. We've got to actually have a senator who actually can fight for all of Georgia and do the things that matter.
New York Times national political reporter Shane Goldmacher joins us now to dive into those two key runoff races in Georgia that will take place on January 5th. Shane Goldmacher, set the stage for us in the Peach State. Explain why one of the people you interviewed for your story today called it the Super Bowl of American politics.
Yeah, there hasn't really been a special set of elections, an overtime election, if you will, quite like this. There are two Senate seats up for grabs in Georgia on January 5th. And right now, the Democrats need exactly two seats to grab the slimmest of majorities and control of the U.S. Senate. If they win both those seats, there would be a 50-50 tie in the Senate, and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would serve as the tiebreaker. And so what's up for grabs in these Georgia Senate races is, frankly, whether or not Joe Biden's going to get to pick the cabinet members that he wants, whether or not Democratic policy priorities are going to get passed through the next Congress. If Mitch McConnell remains in control of the U.S. Senate, it becomes extraordinarily much harder for Joe Biden to enact any kind of a Democratic agenda. And so both sides see this race, these two races, as incredibly important, and commensurate amount of money is getting poured in the story in tomorrow's paper, but online today, is about just how much cash is flowing into Georgia. And it really is unprecedented amount of money.
How much is it?
So far, in just the first 2 weeks since the general election, more than $125 million has been announced, or I've reported finding has been donated into the state. The number is surely larger. There's been $135 million reserved in television ads. Again, this is just in one state. And the ad rates are astronomical. They're higher already than in some of the top presidential battlegrounds in the heat of October. Raphael Warnock, who's a Democrat, he's a pastor, one of the former churches where Martin Luther King Jr. serves at the pulpit. He has raised $40 million in 2 weeks. Just to put that in perspective for a listener, Beto O'Rourke in 2018 set the all-time record then for a Senate candidate in a quarter, so in 90 days, and he raised less than that. So the amount of money flooding into the state is really just unprecedented. Basically, voters are going to need to hide from their televisions, hide from their screens where the digital ads are coming, and hide from their mailboxes because, you know, at this rate, it's going to be one of the more expensive races in the country. And there's not just the Warnock contest. He's running against Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed to her seat about a year ago. There's a second contest between David Perdue, Republican senator, and John Ossoff, his Democratic challenger. So the idea is not just one, but two races simultaneously in overtime in the same state, one-on-one in each of those races. Whoever gets 50% wins. And frankly, both parties presume that the races are going to move in tandem, that if voters are going to go to the polls on January 5th, they're likely going to vote for both Republicans or both Democrats. Now, there could be a little bit of variance there depending on exactly how close it ends up. But to a large extent, the running is tickets. Perdue and Loeffler are holding events together. Warnock and Ossoff are holding events together. And, you know, they're both making their case that this is not just about Georgia, but about the entire country.
Walk us through the election night results in Georgia and what it tells us about who benefits and who's hurt by not having Joe Biden and President Trump on this ballot when voters go back to the polls on January 5th.
Yeah, Georgia is going to end up as one of the closest races in the country at the presidential level. We're going through a recount right now, and Joe Biden has won by a narrow margin. But it's really worth noting what happened down ballot and looking ahead at what that means for January, which is to say that John Ossoff and David Perdue were also on the ballot in November with a third-party candidate who held Perdue just under 50% to send it to a runoff. But in that race, John Ossoff, who's the Democrat, received about 100,000 fewer votes than Joe Biden did. At the same time, David Perdue actually got more votes than Donald Trump, about 700 more votes than Donald Trump. And this is sort of part of the phenomenon that you saw across the country, frankly, which is that down-ballot Republicans outperformed Donald Trump in terms of winning races. And so for Democrats, this is an alarming issue, right? You had Joe Biden win, and yet you had the Democratic Senate candidate finish so far behind him. So that's something they're trying to fix. John Ossoff is running an ad right now, tying himself to Joe Biden. And on the flip side, there was massive turnout in November, and both parties just don't know who's going to vote in January. This is not the usual time for an election. And yes, there's going to be a lot of ads telling people about it. But for David Perdue, you know, Donald Trump really uniquely has brought Republican voters to the polls in Republican, conservative, rural areas. Without Trump atop the ticket, they don't know that those people will turn out. The Democrats don't know how black voters in cities will turn out. And probably most importantly, the white, affluent suburban voters who helped deliver Georgia for Joe Biden, will they come out in January? And if they do, are they going to vote for the Democrat again? Because some of those same voters may not like the idea of Democratic control of the Senate, the House, and the White House. And that's one of the most aggressive cases that the Republicans are going to try to make, that this needs to be a firewall, a check on Democratic power in Washington.
I guess lastly, in our final minute here, are we going to see Joe Biden and Donald Trump in Georgia before January the 5th?
Joe Biden's incoming chief of staff has basically said, yes, you're going to see Joe Biden somewhere before January 5th in Georgia. I expect you might see more than just Joe Biden. You're going to see most of the Democratic major figures. You've already seen a lot of Republicans. Mike Pence is going to be there tomorrow. Tom Cotton, who is a potential future presidential candidate for Republicans, was there. He's there today. Marco Rubio was earlier there this week. Now, Donald Trump, that's the big question, right? If he goes down there and he helps campaign to bring out these voters, it's going to be a big lift for the Republicans. That said, there's a lot of concern, right? Donald Trump has been a politician focused on himself. And if he's the outgoing president, does he really care about a Republican majority in the Senate?
Shane Goldmacher is a national political reporter for The New York Times. You can see his story in tomorrow's paper or read it today online. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This is Washington Today. Our guest this week on C-SPAN's The Weekly podcast is White House Transition Project Director Martha Kumar. She joined us to talk about the tradition of the transition and how it's evolved over the years.
When they were writing the law, they thought that ascertainment would be something that would be an administrative decision. They didn't see it as a political decision. They thought you just look at the votes and figure out how many electoral votes followed from the popular votes, and provide their resources. They didn't see themselves as declaring who's president. They didn't see themselves as taking a place of electoral college. They thought that there was a need to get going before the electoral college met in mid-December. And so they didn't see the problems that would occur, but we now, this is the second election in modern times where ascertainment has been an issue, because it was in 2000 when Bush was running, although that case is different because the it's centered on Florida and the electoral votes there.
That episode of The Weekly podcast will be posted on Friday. You can find it wherever you download your podcasts. More than 2 weeks out from Election Day, there are still a handful of House races yet to be called, but perhaps it's not too early to reflect on the gap between what we thought we knew and what actually happened on election night. Nathan Gonzalez is editor and publisher of one of the leading nonpartisan election analysis newsletters. It's called Inside Elections, and he's out with a new column today in Roll Call about what he got right and wrong when it came to Election 2020. Nathan Gonzalez, let's get right to the prediction that you called the biggest whiff of the cycle and maybe ever for you, that Democrats would expand their House majority by 14 to 20 seats. Instead, we're on the verge of perhaps a Republican double-digit pickup. What happened?
Yeah, that's good, John. Let's lead with the negative instead of what I got right. Even though there's still a handful of House races not called, our projection was off. I expected Democrats to expand their majority, maybe even by double digits, and Republicans are poised to get double digits. And when we, pre-election, when we looked at the data, when we looked at public data, private data, Democratic data, Republican data, it were all pieces to largely the same puzzle, and that was President Trump underperforming and really being an anchor or an anvil around the ankles of these Republican candidates down the ballot. Now, what we learned as the results came in and as the votes were counted is that those polls might have been underestimating President Trump rather than showing an underperformance, and he ended up doing better than expected. And while that wasn't enough to get him a second term, it was enough to help Republicans gain seats in the House.
But it would be the second presidential cycle in a row that the polls were off. Are the polls broken? Is that data just wrong?
Well, this is going to be a discussion we're going to have for at least another 2 or 4 years. I'm not convinced that public opinion polling is permanently broken, that it's just a problem that can't be fixed. I think it is clear, though, that there is a problem when President Trump is on the ballot or when Donald Trump is on the ballot, and because it twice in a row now, it has underestimated his support. And in one cycle, it had a dramatic impact on who we thought was going to win the presidential race. In this case, it had a dramatic impact on the Senate and House races.
What about your Senate predictions? As we sit here today, control of the Senate rests on 2 runoff races in January in Georgia. How far is that from what you expected?
Yeah, well, more than a year ago, in September, October of 2019, we were talking about the Senate being in play, that the control of the Senate was going to be on the line, and it might even go to a runoff race in Georgia, and that's exactly where we stand today. Our specific projection right before the election was a potential of a Democratic gain of 4 to 6 Senate seats. Right now, if Republicans win both races in Georgia, if Democrats win both races in Georgia, that will get them to 3, so it would be just under the lower end of our range. But the overall bottom line that the Senate was going to be up for grabs, I think we got that right, and Democrats still are poised to win. I think there's this part of the post-election narrative that Republicans did better than expected and they have held the Senate, but that is not the case. It is not over when we're talking about control of that chamber.
You said we led with the negative. Let's get to the positive. What'd you get right on?
Well, more than 2 years ago, I was talking about record turnout, that we were going to break turnout records in 2020, and that's exactly where we are today, that President Trump, I think, is a large factor in this, that he did a good job of turning out Republican voters, but he also did a good job of turning out Democratic voters against him, and that's how you get these big numbers. It looks like 66% of voting-eligible Americans voted. More than 156 million people voted, and so that's one thing that we saw coming.
Any other things that you think you got right?
Well, the idea that election night would never be the same, even before the pandemic and before the increased access to early voting and voting by mail, I think it was clear that we would not have conclusive results on election night, and that's what happened. President-elect Biden wasn't declared the president-elect until Saturday. There were a number of races that were too close to call, not just at the presidential level, but at the Senate and House level. And so I think that's one of the key things that we could see coming down the line, even if some of the specifics weren't apparently clear.
And I guess lastly, if there's one individual race prediction that you could get back, what do you think it would be?
Well, the one race that was not on our list of competitive races was Donna Shalala, the Democratic congresswoman from South Florida, that Republicans ended up picking up that seat along with the neighboring seat held by another Democratic congresswoman. There were pieces of evidence that this might be in play, but I didn't think that there was enough data to show that Republicans were on the cusp of taking over a seat that Hillary Clinton won easily 4 years ago, but obviously that was wrong. And I will say, the last thing about polling and getting it all wrong again is that there's this idea that this is like 2016 again, but there's one huge difference in that the data for months have pointed to Joe Biden having the lead or the advantage in this race, and he won. The margins in the polls in some specific states were not correct, but the idea that the polls were completely off, I think, is just a little bit too much of a broad brush when we're looking at this.
Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections. It's insideelections.com. He also has a column at Roll Call, rollcall.com. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. No problem.
And we appreciate you, our listeners' time today on Washington Today. If you've missed any part of this program, remember, you can listen to it wherever you listen to your podcast. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.